Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org with your feedback and your segment ideas. I understand this morning that the head of the MEDC has declared that any pure Michigan advertising moving forward that includes a reference to right to work has officially been put on hold here. So that stirred up a little controversy in the Wall Street Journal here not too long ago. So I guess we're going to leave that controversy behind us if I interpret this thing correctly. President Obama called for an increase in the federal minimum wage this week in his State of the Union address. Michigan legislative Democrats, as you've probably heard, have followed up with their own calls for an increase as well. Republicans at all levels say that would be a job killer. Charles Ballard's a professor of economics at Michigan State University and the director of the State of the State Survey, and he joins me in the studio to talk about the debate over the minimum wage and as many other topics as we have time for. Talk fast, Charlie.
Thanks, Mark. Nice to be on the program.
Welcome. This is not a new debate. This topic comes up periodically. If you would, first, sum up the arguments for raising the minimum wage.
The argument for raising the minimum wage is that the current federal minimum at $7.25 an hour, that means that if you work full-time and that's your only source of income, that gets you not quite to $15,000 a year, which if you've got a family of four, that's not enough to get out of poverty. Mm-hmm. So if you raise the minimum wage and if those folks keep their jobs, it helps to reduce poverty. The downside, as has been pointed out, is that we don't know if all those folks will keep their jobs. We know that employers may respond by building new machines to replace the low-skilled, low-wage workers or something. We know that if the wage goes up, there may be some either some folks who lose a job or some folks who are unable to find a job in the first place. And the big debate among economists is how big is that effect? Obviously, if you have millions of folks who have their wage go up and only one person loses his or her job, well, that's a trade-off that most of us would take. Mm-hmm. If only a few people have their wage goes up and there's massive disemployment and unemployment, then that's a trade-off that a lot of us wouldn't take. And so how big is that job loss? My sense is that the, relatively speaking, the increase in the earnings of those who do keep their jobs is likely to be bigger than the job losses. But even that statement is controversial because there are a lot of studies by economists and they don't all reach exactly the same conclusion. One other thing that I would mention about the minimum wage is that it's not targeted at low-income people. It's targeted at low-wage folks. And so at least some of the people who benefit from the higher minimum wage are teenagers in affluent families. In other words, it's not a – it's a fairly blunt instrument. If your goal is to reduce poverty and if some of the people who have a higher minimum wage are kids whose father is a lawyer and mother is a doctor, well – that's not really reducing poverty
right.
very much.
Now, do economists factor that dynamic into their arguments?
Oh, sure.
Generally?
And that's why economists generally are much more favorably disposed toward the earned income tax credit, which is the federal policy that was instituted in 1975 and then expanded under President Reagan, under President Bush, and then under the first Bush, and then under Clinton. And recently, Michigan added an add-on to the earned income tax credit where we top up the federal EITC by 20%. Then last year—
The whole thing got
well,
down.
Well, it was reduced by 70%, so we now top up the federal by only 6%. I'd love to see that go up because that is an anti-poverty program that actually stimulates employment, whereas the minimum wage may lead to some employment losses.
I want to clarify here. I'm not sure I knew this. Michigan's EITC was not completely shelved then.
No, there was talk of getting rid of it entirely, but a compromise was reached, and we still have a much reduced Michigan EITC.
Here with the very familiar argument against raising the minimum wage, this is Wall Street Journal columnist Kim Strassel on Wednesday of this week.
If you demand that the minimum wage goes up. Companies are paying that much more every time they hire a worker and for overall costs. And usually what that means for employers is that they don't hire. They do not grow their businesses. It's businesses that cannot be put into future investment and growth. And so it's overall a bad thing for the economy.
How much weight do you assign to that? I mean, you've come out in, you say the benefits outweigh the costs in the final analysis, but that would be the major cost of raising. Is she right about that?
Oh, I think that's a legitimate argument. I think when business groups talk in terms of they're opposed to it because they wouldn't hire as much and they wouldn't investment as much, I would also add that I think the biggest reason that they don't like it is that they would prefer to get their workers for less and they would prefer higher profits. But quite apart from that, it is a legitimate argument. We do believe that there are some employment losses, and that's why I give the minimum wage only a C or so, whereas I give the earned income tax credit an A. And if it were up to me, I would have a combination of policies. I'm not against raising the minimum wage. I wouldn't raise it too high, and I would look to other policies to try to improve the lives of low-wage workers, because that is a group that has been hammered in the United States economy in the last 40 years.
$10 an hour too high?
You know, I referred to the controversy among economists. What we know is we have studies based on the data that we have. The bigger the increase, the more uncertain we would be about how large the
impact would be.
If we try it, my guess is that it would be okay, but I'm trying to hedge my bets in terms of that, especially since there are other policies that are so much more effective.
Is this the kind of policy that you see a compromise on? In other words, does it either $10 an hour passes or it goes down, or $8.50, $9 an hour becomes feasible?
I think something like that is very possible. In fact, my guess is that when President Obama put out $9 an hour, he did not expect that would happen.
Right.
He expects that if anything happens, maybe it would be $8. You know, one other thing that the president suggested was tying it to the inflation rate. So, and that would be an interesting change, because what we've had in the past is we wait several years and then we ratchet it up by a substantial amount. Well, what we could do, if you tied it to inflation, then you wouldn't have these big jumps and you wouldn't have it erode a whole lot due to inflation over a long period of time, and then it jumps up, and that sort of a ratcheting it up and down.
We're talking with MSU Professor of Economics Charlie Ballard. There are poverty guidelines that are used for determining eligibility for various programs. But is there some yearly statistic that's calculated that determines how much income a person or family actually needs to pay bills, like some kind of caloric guidelines? You need X calories to live each day. Does the minimum wage bear any resemblance to that?
The minimum wage is not way far from what it would take to get a family of two out of poverty, according to our official poverty. And in fact, the poverty rate that gets quoted, it's a little bit more than $20,000 for a family of four. It came from some calculations 50 years ago or so, where what they did was they said, okay, what's the minimum number of calories that you have to survive and not get sick? And then they made some adjustments to that. So it was that kind of a calculation. And then it's been updated on the basis of inflation ever since. And it's a different number for a family of one, two, three, four, five. For a family of four, it's a little bit more than $20,000. And so the minimum wage is enough to get a family of one out of poverty. It's not enough to get a family of four out of poverty.
I'm always baffled by these discussions of the multiples of the poverty level that always get batted around. How is it 200% of the poverty level or 300% of the poverty level is central to these discussions?
Well, the poverty line is a fairly arbitrary number. And just because you get $1 above the poverty line doesn't mean that you're doing really well in the United States. And so there are a lot of programs, Medicaid is one, where eligibility is conditioned on being some multiple of the poverty line, because there's a desire not just to get to help those who are below the poverty line, but, you know, if you're at 1.2, if you're 120% of the poverty line or 140% of the poverty line, that is still a fairly needy group by modern American standards.
Let's talk for a few minutes about a huge national and international issue right now, and it's austerity versus stimulus. Briefly summarize those different approaches, will you?
Well, we have in much of the world, and certainly in the U.S., we had this catastrophe 4 years ago, this dramatic financial crisis, which put the economy into a tailspin. And what that was it was a contraction of the private sector. The private sector failed badly because of the banking collapse. Well, when that happens, if the private sector is shrinking, and if nobody steps in to try to offset that, you can make the recession worse. And that's why since the 1930s, when we really figured out some things about this, when economists gained a better understanding of it, since the 1930s, we've understood that if you're in a recession, that federal budget deficits can help to offset the contraction in the private sector. And that's why it was a good thing that we did not rush to try to balance the budget back 4 years ago. If we had done that, we would have made the recession far worse. That's what happened. That's one of the many things that happened in the Great Depression of the 1930s was that they didn't use fiscal policy in an expansionary way as they probably should have. Now, the downside of that is that when you run those deficits, that adds to the national debt.
Right.
And the danger, if you push it too far, is that you become Greece. Now, we are nowhere close to Greece now. Investors all around the world are still happy to buy U.S. government debt. But economists do worry that at some point in the future, these deficits and debt would become unsustainable. And so that's why it's a very delicate balancing act. You want to ease on the brakes over the long period, or else your debt will get out of control. But you don't want to slam on the brakes, because that will send the economy into a deeper recession. And so finding the right balance between those competing objectives, that is the great challenge for policy. And it's a very difficult challenge.
I hear that referred to as gas now, brakes later. Is that right?
Yeah, I think certainly I would not want to slam on the brakes now, but we do have to apply the brakes. If we had sensible policy, and of course, getting sensible policy out of Washington is a real challenge. But if we had some sensible policy, what we would do would be to slowly, gradually ease on the brakes over a very long period of time. And we would do other things to try to stabilize the financial system in a way that would mean that we've got an economy that will do okay 10, 20 years from now.
I want to make sure I understand. The case basically for gas now, brakes later is that the economy is just barely percolating along. If we hit the gas now, we would gain more in public revenue over the short term to make the longer term deficit more manageable.
Yes, I think that's a good way to describe it.
Okay.
Yes, because if you slam on the brakes now and put millions of people out of work, well, they're not going to be paying any taxes. And that can actually make your deficit problem worse over the long haul.
Is there a situation acknowledged by economists where austerity has been exactly the policy to follow? Has worked?
Well,
in modern times, anyway.
I guess it depends upon how much austerity you're talking about, because clearly you can't just run infinite budget deficits. But I think that we, when you look at countries like Greece, like Mexico 20 years ago, like others that have gotten into trouble, they have had their unsustainable debt situations. And if nobody's willing to lend to you, then you've got to do something to reduce your deficits. The better policy would be not to get into that situation in the first place. And that's what I hope we can do in the United States, although it remains to be seen.
Peter Coy, in a recent issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, claims that there's a danger involved in thinking of the United States as a family that needs to get its spending under control. And I'm thinking there are enough people who may think this way. I may have thought this way in the past. It might behoove us to explain Coy's thinking on this. Why is it risky, or why might it be risky, to compare the national economy with a spendthrift American family that just needs to cut back?
You hear that analogy a lot. And it's an analogy that has at least some merit, because of course we have to pay our bills at some point. But one big difference between the United States and a household is that the household under the bankruptcy laws, the household has to pay its debts within its lifetime. The United States is going to last for a very, very long time, long after you and I are no longer on this mortal coil. I'm sorry to say that to you, Mark, but it's going to last for a long time. That means that we don't have to pay back the national debt. We could pay some of it down, but there's no requirement that we end at a particular date with zero national debt. We can just roll it over. That's what we've been doing for a long time. We can roll over that national debt and maintain a solid financial system. So in answer to your question, the household is similar to the nation in some ways, but is fundamentally different in other ways. And the other thing is, if the individual household cuts back, it can improve its financial situation. But if the nation cuts back too far, too fast, too hard, then it'll get into a situation where people are laid off, then they can't spend, you know, the barber gets laid off and doesn't have any money to spend at the hardware store, then the hardware store has to lay off some people, then those workers don't have any money to go to the movies, then the movies have to, right, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's how the analogy is very imperfect.
Charles Ballard's a professor of economics at Michigan State University and the director of the State of the State Survey. This has been fun. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Many couples take a trip after their wedding. That trip, of course, is called a honeymoon. But have you ever heard of a trip called a baby moon? It's the same idea, a romantic getaway, but in this case, think of it as the last chance for a couple to take such a trip before their first child is born. WKAR Scott Pohl reports.
To be honest, I'd never heard the word baby moon before my son and daughter-in-law recently planned one. Zach and Stephanie Pohl have a baby on the way, and yes, little Stella, due next month, will be my first grandchild. Stephanie got the idea from stories in People and Us magazines about celebrities taking baby moons.
I read those magazines every week. I hear about these celebrities that are expecting their babies, and they cover everything about what they're doing, and baby moons are such a big thing. It just seemed like a really wonderful idea to have that last hurrah vacation together as a couple before the baby.
Do a Google News search on the word baby moon right now, and you'll find lots of stories speculating on Prince William and Kate Middleton traveling to the Caribbean before their baby arrives. Kanye West and Kim Kardashian took a baby moon in Paris. The Poles chose Sedona, Arizona for their baby moon.
We decided to go somewhere that we had never been before, something that maybe offered something a little different than a typical vacation, and maybe something that wouldn't necessarily be something that we'd plan on doing with a family one day, like going to Florida.
They picked a resort offering a baby moon package with a spa that included a maternity massage. Lots of vacation spots are offering massages and other amenities for their pregnant guests. You don't have to travel all that far to take a baby moon. In South Haven, The Monroe Manor Inn offers a baby moon package. Owner Doug Bryant has offered it for about 4 years.
It's the largest suite in the inn, and it also has a soaking tub in the bathroom that's extra deep. They'll also receive a one-hour couples massage with certified pregnancy massage therapists, a $50 Visa gift card. Most of our couples usually use it for one of the restaurants that we have in town.
Bryant also throws in a gift basket of baby items. The Monroe Manor Inn offers both weekend and weekday baby moon packages, and Bryant says baby moons are his most popular offerings. Is this a trend that could really take off, and is the tourism industry of Michigan ready? Michelle Benash, Public Relations Manager of Travel Michigan, thinks there's potential for growth here. She says baby moon packages aren't that different from the romantic travel packages many resorts already offer.
You know, instead of a bottle of champagne, you have a bottle of non-alcoholic champagne. Instead of a couple's massage, you have a prenatal massage. And so there's ways that they can really have fun with this. I know one of them offers a jar of pickles with all of their baby moon packages. So there's ways to play with it and have fun with it and take what they already have and tweak it towards this audience.
Benash says people are always looking for new reasons to travel, and it's important to tap into those new ideas. She adds that visitors who have a good experience could find themselves planning a return visit after their baby arrives.
You know, the other great thing is we're looking at people who are about to have families. So they're coming to Michigan and having this great experience, and the idea that that would translate once they have families to bringing their families back here is a really big one.
Of course, travel during pregnancy comes with some limitations. Dr. Joel Maurer is a board-certified obstetrician-gynecologist with the Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. He says travel is usually safe during the second trimester and not unreasonable up to about 36 weeks. He advises frequent stops and walking on trips of more than a couple of hours to prevent blood clots.
Get out of the car, stretch your legs for 10 minutes every 90 minutes or an hour and a half down the road. If you're in an airplane, and you know your flight's going to be more than a couple hours, make sure that you get up, walk up and down the aisles.
Dr. Maurer cautions that some airlines won't allow you to fly after the 36th week of pregnancy. They want to avoid in-flight emergencies or childbirth 35,000 feet above the ground. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists offers lots of information about travel during pregnancy, such as limiting car trips to no more than 5 or 6 hours a day, booking an aisle seat on flights to facilitate stretching your legs, and ways to avoid norovirus infections while on a cruise. Stephanie Pohl enjoyed her baby moon so much that she'll advise her friends to consider one when they're first-time mothers-to-be.
It would be something I'd recommend to anybody, and it doesn't have to be getting on a plane and going somewhere. It could be taking a short road trip or just going up north, getting away for a little while. I would completely recommend it.
Will baby moons ever be as commonplace as honeymoons? Perhaps not, but with people ranging from Prince William and Kate to my son and his wife taking one, maybe baby moons are on their way to a more prominent place in our minds. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Coming up on the program, Michigan's famous and forgotten authors. Dave and Jack Dempsey have written Ink Trails. Learn all about them. That's coming up. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're tuned to Current State. Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. What do you know about the Sunshine Review? The Sunshine Review, it's an organization that tracks transparency and openness at all levels of government, and it periodically grades those governments on transparency. The latest grades just came out. The state of Michigan, B-. I'm thinking the governor isn't crazy about that grade since he's explicitly discussed making Michigan government more transparent, B-. It apparently didn't do well on account of difficult navigation of the state website, Michigan.gov. So difficult navigation, no information on taxpayer-funded lobbying, and not all departments have information for filing Freedom of Information requests. It scored high, however, in other areas, since all of the following can be found at Michigan.gov. Audits, budgets and lobbyist reports, vendor payments, and the state phone directory. And I was a little surprised that the city of Lansing got an A- from the Sunshine Review. Every other Michigan city I'm looking at here did not do as well. Detroit and Flint, C-. Warren, D. Grand Rapids, B. Lansing, A-. And I think maybe more than the actual grade itself, I think I'm mostly surprised that didn't trigger a press release. If it did, it slipped through the cracks. Check out all the grades yourself at sunshinereview.org. Sunshinereview.org. Dave Dempsey is a widely respected Michigan environmentalist and writer. His attorney brother, Jack, is also a writer. Together, their love for Michigan and the written word are united in Ink Trails, Michigan's Famous and Forgotten Authors. The book has been chosen as a Michigan Notable Book for 2013. Jack and Dave Dempsey will visit the Schuler Bookstore in Okemos tomorrow at 2 p.m. to talk about Ink Trails. That's Saturday at 2 p.m. to talk about their book, and they join us today to talk more about Michigan's rich literary history. Jack and Dave, welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Almost everybody's familiar with some of the writers included in this book. Jack Dempsey, who would you say are the most recognizable, successful writers from Michigan?
I would submit that Bruce Catton, the preeminent Civil War historian, is well known, mm-hmm. at least in that genre. Also Carl Sandburg, who wrote both history, poetry. There's a national site for people to visit where he wrote down in North Carolina. So those are two very famous writers, I would submit.
Dave Dempsey?
Well, I would agree with that. My mind turns first to those that are less notable, and those are the ones that we were hoping the book would introduce to new audiences. So
we're going to get to that.
I'm not really answering your question. I'm going ahead to your next question. But Marita Wolf is a writer that I found very fascinating, somebody no one today knows about and is, I think, worth knowing about. At one point, a children's writer named Marguerite D'Angeli may have been a very well-known Michigan author, but perhaps not so today, but she's worth remembering, too.
We'll get a little bit more into the lesser-known Michigan writers here in a minute. First of all, what qualified a writer as a Michigan writer, Jack Dempsey? Born here, lived here, what?
Both, or either. You were born here or you lived here. You spent some time in Michigan at some point in your life, but you drew inspiration from some aspect of Michigan, its natural beauty, its people, the situation you found yourself in, any of those connections. And as Dave said, some of these were very famous in their day, like Will Carleton. There used to be a state holiday after him, dedicated to him. Now no one knows who he is, but he was born in Michigan, became famous nationally, and now is obscure.
Dave Dempsey, tell us more about what qualified a Michigan. Did all of these Michigan writers explicitly write about Michigan, or not?
I wouldn't say they do. They did. To me, what qualified them, and I think perhaps to Jack as well, is that Michigan needed to play some kind of an influence in their writing directly or indirectly. There were writers who I think in the book who may not have mentioned Michigan much, but they used Michigan as their writing den, so to speak, and they drew sustenance from either the people or the landscape of the state. So a couple of the writers that I looked at were clearly motivated by just their love of Michigan's beauty, and I think that kind of thing is true of many of the writers.
I think it's safe to say you've really got to be into Michigan and Michigan writers to be aware of all of the names in your book. Jack, why don't you run through a couple of the lesser-known writers for us as far as you're concerned and why you included them.
One is Carol Watson Rankin. She was a basically housewife up in Marquette, decided that she wanted to be a writer when she was young, but in that society it was almost impossible to become a writer in that era, in that location. But she wrote under a pseudonym, published a number of books basically for young women, and the most famous, Dandelion Cottage, still in print today. A fascinating book, and oddly, one that a friend of mine happened to treasure as a family memento down in southeast Michigan. So here's a writer from Marquette who probably no one south of the bridge knows about, and yet here's a close friend of mine who cherished this book, and since it's still available, others can cherish it as well and pass it down. It's a wonderful book about some young women and their escapades up in Marquette.
And Dave Dempsey, tell us a little bit more about Merida Wolfe. This is somebody you obviously feel pretty strongly about.
Yeah, I really do. I'd never heard of her myself, even though I pride myself on having been a reader for most of my life and enjoying books. And somebody just mentioned her name to me, and I Googled her and then read all seven of her novels, and I found her just fascinating. She grew up in the Grass Lake area down by Jackson and wrote some what I would call really almost noirish books about the people and culture of small town Michigan back in the 1930s and 40s. One of the really interesting vignettes to me about her is that she stopped writing novels after about 1972. Her last novel was rejected by a publisher, but she thought it was good enough to put in a refrigerator in a box and keep there until after her death. She was afraid if, you know, there was a house fire, the manuscript would burn up. So the manuscript was actually retrieved after her death and published and reviewed favorably back in 2005 in the New York Times. So she was quite a character.
And Jack Dempsey, tell us more about Will Carleton. You touched on him just a minute ago. We got to hear this story. How was it Will Carleton had, did you say a state holiday? Had a state holiday in his honor? And he is almost completely forgotten now. How did that happen?
He was up there in the pantheon of Lincoln and Washington and Thanksgiving Day, school days that kids got off. He was just such a well-known poet back in the day and had such an impact nationally. His first piece, Betsy and I Are Out, is a rather interesting poem that has to do with the breakup of a couple, married couple, and it became a sensation. Led the way for him to write more poems, and he published quite a number of books. And there is a village in Michigan called Carleton. There is a Will Carleton Road. In fact, if you're going down I-275 in southeast Michigan, you have to cross under it. But as many people are wont to do, they see something, they don't really pay attention to it. I put myself in that category. And so Carleton Road, one day I thought, well, who is Will Carleton? And so we began to investigate it, and Dave and I found this individual to be a fascinating writer and poet.
When did he live? And you, are you saying he was from southeast Michigan?
Yes, he was born in Hudson, Michigan, and he lived from 1845 to 1912.
And how did this happen? How was it he became so utterly anonymous over time?
I think, in a way, his poetry is unique to its time. It's a certain style of poetry that probably today we aren't as enamored with. But it's just one of the phenomena of Michigan that something becomes very pronounced and famous, and over time we tend to forget about it. We do not cherish our history as much as we should.
We're talking with Jack and Dave Dempsey, the authors of Ink Trails, Michigan's famous and forgotten authors. Jack, you had a reading that you wanted to share with us here. Is this Will Carleton by any chance?
No, this is someone else named Eugene Ruggles, born in Pontiac, lived in Elk Rapids, went to Wayne State, Northern Michigan University, ended up on the West Coast, and again, another individual who's not really well-known, but whose poetry, as one individual, one friend said, should pass on into the American canon.
Eugene Ruggles, he lived when? In 19th century, we're talking?
No, in the 20th century.
Oh.
Born in 35, and he died in 2004.
Oh, my.
And I should go back, as Dave was talking about qualifications, you do have to be deceased to be in our book.
Okay. All right.
We don't want to run into any litigation involved in it. So.
Okay. But this is Eugene Ruggles.
Ruggles returned again and again to scenes of urban Detroit and Flint, where workers paid the penalty for a floundering economy and the poor judgment of management. He had toiled in Detroit factories in his youth and identified viscerally with the suffering of former assembly line workers turned out of their jobs. Ruggles' poems sometimes spoke of matters distant from Michigan, but remained rooted in an outlook shaped by his childhood in the Wolverine State. Unflinching in their portrayal of family tragedy, passionate political action, and social decay, Ruggles' poems have their source in a fundamentally American character shaped by the alternately gentle and brutal hands of Michigan.
Hmm. Dave Dempsey, who would you say is the most unfairly overlooked writer you profile in the book?
Wow, that's a tough question. You know, I grew up loving Bruce Cadden, and he is, I think, fairly well remembered today, but primarily because of his Civil War writings. And this, of course, is the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. But to me, his best book is the one that's forgotten, and that's Waiting for the Morning Train. It's a story about growing up in Michigan in the early 20th century. I just think it's a gem. It's really a magnificent masterpiece. That's the kind of book we should have kids in Michigan schools all read.
Waiting for the Morning Train by Bruce Cadden.
Correct.
Okay. Dave Dempsey, Jack, what about you?
Well, I think Liberty Hyde Bailey is someone else that we ought to pay attention to, someone who's associated with Michigan State University, as both Dave
very,
and I
very close
are.
Yes.
And there's a Bailey Scholars program, and there's a small museum in South Haven where you can go visit his family home when he was being raised. And to think that this individual basically launched the entire horticulture, landscape architecture program in American colleges at Cornell in New York State, became very pronounced with his studies, with his teaching. And his writings are also very interesting because he talks about the natural world and how we need to nurture it and care for it, something that we've rediscovered since, I guess, 1970.
Is Bailey Street in East Lansing, or the Bailey neighborhood, is that named? Do we know if that's named after Liberty Hyde Bailey? I want to say yes.
Of course.
But, we all want to say yes since I've raised the question. But I think I have heard that in the past. I don't think it would surprise anybody.
Well, there's a statue here on the state campus, so you can go see it over there at the Hort Garden.
Okay. You did not include Ernest Hemingway. Why not?
I'll let Dave speak to that.
Well, two reasons. One is so much has been said about Ernest Hemingway that I wasn't sure that we could add, at this point, anything original and complimentary. And secondly, the secondary purpose of the book really was to try to commemorate and celebrate as many forgotten writers as we could. Part of the, I think, purpose of this whole book, which was a labor of love for Jack and me, is just to refresh and inspire Michigan readers to pick up books otherwise might not have. And I think plenty of people pick up Hemingway, but not too many pick up Liberty Hyde Bailey.
And we've got about 30 seconds here. What does it mean for the book to be named a Michigan Notable Book for 2013?
Well, I would say it's extremely gratifying, humbling, and just a recognition on the part of those who review this that this is well worthy of people reading.
Dave Dempsey and his brother Jack are the authors of Ink Trails, Michigan's famous and forgotten authors, and they will be speaking at the Schuler Bookstore in Okemos tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock to talk about Ink Trails. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, very much.
Current state on WKAR, we're glad you're here. The MSU women's basketball team are at Michigan tomorrow at noon. The MSU men travel to Lincoln to battle Nebraska tomorrow night. That's an 8 p.m. tip on the Big Ten Network, and the Free Press's Joe Rexrow joins us to talk about that and other sports news. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I'm just fine, thank you. You write about injuries in your piece this morning in the Free Press, but it's becoming easy to overlook injuries after the huge win against Michigan. How concerned should we be about injuries to the Spartans?
Well, obviously, the Brandon Dawson thing was scary. He was the latest. It seems like every game now someone goes to the locker room, at least every game at Breslin Center. So good news for the Spartans that he was fine, and it was just a cut to the lip. There was some concern at the time that maybe he also had a concussion. Of course, Travis Trice is still suffering from the concussion-like symptoms. It's a concern with Travis Trice. I mean, this is going to be his fourth straight game out. This team still does not have great perimeter depth, and there's really no word at all on when he'll be cleared. It just comes down to he tried to do a little bit in practice yesterday, and then he just kind of had to shut it down. He's sensitive to light and noise, and unless there's just no trace of any of that, he's going to be sitting, and that I do think is a concern. Although it's harder to say that, I guess, after the way Michigan State performed the other night.
Exactly. In number one, Indiana. We'll put the Michigan game in some perspective for us. I know you've already written about this. This is a couple days ago, but it was such a huge win. What was the takeaway there for you?
Well, yeah, I certainly didn't see it coming. I don't think I didn't talk to anyone who thought blowout in this game, but it was a tremendous defensive effort. I think it was the best of the season, and I do think Michigan maybe was tired at the end of a tough stretch and things like that. But, all the things Michigan did poorly, I think you have to give credit to Michigan State for making it happen. So it was an eye-opening performance. It's the kind of performance that now has people talking nationally about Michigan State as a national title contender and people down on Michigan. And I still think both of those teams have a real chance to get to the Final Four.
And number one, Indiana is on the right. We don't want to shortchange Nebraska here, but we do have another huge matchup on Tuesday night. Number one, Indiana on the radar in what will be a scorcher on Tuesday night. Where's your head at on at the risk of putting the cart before the horse here? We do have Nebraska Saturday night. What are you anticipating about Indiana?
Yeah, Tom Izzo wouldn't like that at all. But luckily, media, we can say whatever we want. he can tell he's on high alert about overlooking Nebraska. But, if Michigan State does win at Nebraska, as the Spartans should, you're probably talking about number one against number five. Actually a bigger game than last week. Now, will the crowd be as engaged, as raucous as it was Tuesday? I don't know. That may be the loudest I've ever heard Breslin Center, which is quite a statement. I've heard it loud many, many times over the years. But can the fans rev it back up again? And can the team, if Michigan State, wins Saturday and wins Tuesday, then I think Michigan State is in great shape to at least share the Big Ten championship if you look at the remaining schedules.
What's the line in the Nebraska game?
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
That's a good question. I don't know. I imagine it's probably in the 10 range, I would think. Nebraska came here and was down two with a minute and change left in the game a few weeks ago, and Nebraska was missing its best big man in that game. So that's probably a good thing for Michigan State, and I know Tom Izzo is probably mentioning that often because Nebraska, you know, almost beat Ohio State at home a couple weeks ago, so it's not like this is just a complete pushover.
No, we don't mean to suggest that. Tom will probably make us run some lines here before we're through. Were you able to see the Minnesota-Wisconsin game last night?
I snuck in a look at the last few minutes in overtime, and that's a huge win for the rest of the Big Ten because Wisconsin only played Michigan and Indiana once this year, really has the biggest scheduling break in the Big Ten, and the rest of the schedule, other than a trip here, is very easy for Wisconsin. So had Wisconsin pulled that out, the Badgers were probably going to be in great shape to finish 14-4, and that may have been, you know, enough for the outright or at least a share of the title. So, and that's a big win for Minnesota, too. It was a heck of a game.
We're down to less than a minute. You've got a quick, short football story in the paper today, too. We got a Spartan football assistant talking to the New Orleans Saints. What's going on?
Yeah, and I haven't been able to talk to Dan Roshar, but he is a candidate, interestingly, for the running backs coach job in New Orleans. So he was scheduled to be interviewed yesterday. I don't know if it actually took place or if things got moved around at all. But, you know, Dan Roshar interviewed with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers a year ago, too. So there are teams in the NFL interested in him as a coach. And so that'll be interesting. There are some other good candidates. Maurice Carthon is a longtime assistant in the NFL, and he was a very good NFL fullback. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And if he does get that job, what Mark D'Antonio would do at offensive coordinator. Because obviously he'd have to hire someone from outside to fill some spot, but would he move someone around? Maybe a Brad Salem, maybe a Dave Warner. Brad Salem's his running backs coach. Dave Warner is his quarterback coach. Maybe one of those two guys
okay. Would
be his offensive coordinator.
Very good. Safe journeys to Lincoln. Joe, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mark. Appreciate it.
This Sunday night at 9, WKAR-TV presents the two-hour Season 3 finale of the hit PBS TV series, Downton Abbey. The storm und drang of the third season brought us the wedding of Mary and Matthew, the death of Sybil, the near financial ruin of the estate itself, and many more joys and heartbreaks. Millions of viewers nationwide will be tuned in to see what this year's final installment brings in what it may promise for Season 4. Even WKAR Radio is getting in on the Downton Act tonight at 7 p.m., 90.5 Classical. This station presents At Home with John Lund, the composer of the Downton Abbey soundtrack. The 2012 radio show is the creation of then WFMT Chicago VP of Content Peter Wharf, now WKAR's radio station manager. And Downton composer John Lund is featured in the two-hour special, which showcases music from the Downton Abbey soundtrack and some of Lund's personal favorite compositions of Edwardian-era England and more. One-time BBC producer and host John Tolansky anchors the show. Here's an excerpt.
The theme music from Downton Abbey, haunting, evocative, and highly atmospheric, and a very important part of the visual and theatrical experience of the award-winning television series, composed by John Lunn, a remarkably eclectic musician with a very large roster of music for films, television, and also the Opera House, the Symphony Orchestra, and many other areas. One of the most remarkable qualities of Downton Abbey is here we have this period piece. You've created the magic and the frisson of that period, but it's very contemporary. It's not pastiche, and I think that's a very remarkable quality.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's hard even for me to pin down why I should be able to do that, but I think it's partly because I have I do have a great interest in a great variety of music, and also my education. I did a degree in music at university, and the professor there, although he was probably in his 60s, he was absolutely obsessed with harmony and counterpoint. I mean, for 3 years we had to do, we did like 2 fugues in the style of Bach per week, right? You know, and it was hard work, yeah. But my God, I learned how to write me. I mean, I just, my sense of harmony, which is where, you know, all music comes from, I completely understand it. And if I hear something, I can tell what the harmony is, and, you know, and then, you know, I can kind of circumvent it, I can move it around, I can, you know, and everything comes from Bach.
Well, there's a suite on the CD,
yeah,
which you compiled, and that, of course, contains quite a lot of these items.
It does. It must contain about five or six.
So I think we should hear that. This is the suite from Downton Abbey on the CD, which is the Downton Abbey CD featuring the theme music plus lots of extracts from the series, at least the first series. And it's the Chamber Orchestra of London, conducted by Alistair King.
Monday on Current State, Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings and Lansing medical marijuana lobbyist Robin Schneider on the new proposal regarding medical marijuana distribution in Michigan. It's Current State.